compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Fact.
Welcome back. The number is 888-914-9149. This is an amazing coincidence, I guess. I was just talking on the program in the last hour, toward the end of the last hour, in case you missed it, about the cancel culture. We talked about a guy who was going to be one of the new guest hosts for Jeopardy, but he lost that job because of some unfortunate tweets, things that he said as a joke that were dumb and offensive, but he said them like, you know, 6-8 years ago. And the people who make it their business to dig through people's online rubbish, they found these things, and that caused him to not get his job because Sony, who owns the company, they didn't want to have somebody like that, and they knew that there would be lots of pressure, et cetera, et cetera. Well, it just so happens that over the break, a friend of mine sent me a link to a story that's circulating right now about General Mike Flynn, who was part of the previous administration in the White House, including screenshots here from Chase Bank. They're canceling his credit cards, citing a possible reputational risk to their company. So here's what the screenshot allegedly says from Chase, if in fact this is real, but it's from a variety of different sources, so it does appear to be real. And the screenshot is the upper part of the letter that comes from Chase with the headline, "We are closing your credit cards. After careful consideration, we decided to close your credit cards on September 18th, 2021, because continuing the relationship creates possible reputational risk to our company. You may receive additional account closing notifications if you have other accounts under a different name or address." In other words, we're wiping you out clean. And that's just because of his associations, I guess, politically. Another person who's reporting on this with a link to the government's own website. This is justice.gov. JP Morgan Chase and Company agrees to pay $920 million in connection with schemes to defraud precious metals in U.S. Treasuries markets. Now, I don't know if, in fact, General Flynn, because I haven't read this yet, it just came to me. I only just found it in the last 5 minutes. I don't know if he has any connection with that directly or indirectly, but he's canceled. He's canceled just like that. Well, his credit cards are anyway. So what an interesting coincidence. And I texted the buddy of mine who sent this to me, and I said, "Are you listening to the program right now? Because I'm talking about this right now." He says, "No, I'm not listening to it right now." So what do you think about that, Cyrus? That's kind of interesting, isn't it?
Happens all the time.
Just be careful what you say. Oh, by the way, a baby was born to Afghan parents. The baby was technically born in Germany, but this is on one of those final flights out of Kabul, Afghanistan, after the Taliban took over. It was on an American C-17 aircraft that was evacuating passengers to Germany. And the baby, the mother was in labor during the flight. In fact, it says that she began experiencing complications from being on the flight at altitude. So the crew helped to stabilize and save the mother's life by descending to a lower altitude that increased the air pressure inside the aircraft. I'm not sure how that helped, but it did. It saved her life, and they delivered the baby right there on the airplane, because once they landed, there was no time to get her to a hospital. So medics came on board the plane and delivered the baby then and there. So technically, the baby was born in Germany, but the baby could have been born in flight, and they named the baby Reach. She's a little girl. Now, why Reach? That was my reaction. It's just kind of an odd name. Can you imagine naming your child Reach and knowing that forever, for the rest of that person's life, she's always going to have to explain to everybody what that name means? Reach, what kind of a name is Reach? Well, that was the code name or the call signal for the airplane that they were flying on. Reach 828 was the call name for that aircraft. So they named her Reach.
Kids lucky will always have an icebreaker story in every situation.
That's true. And she'll probably be the only girl named Reach in her kindergarten class.
I'll even say the only kid named Reach.
Not just in her class, but in her school.
Yeah, maybe.
And the school district. That's right. And the state. I remember a time, I've always liked the name Jennifer, and I always liked the name Jessica. And I remember when, probably long about the early 80s, it seemed like every other girl was named Jessica or Jennifer. And now, nobody. Very rare. 888-914-9149. I want to bring up one item, then we're going to go to the phones. Some of you may have heard our friend Sam call in, and he was in distress, and he said that he's got people who are urging him to go into a rest home, and others who are urging him to quit his business and, you know, just not do his job anymore. But he's feeling kind of desperate because that's his livelihood and he has to do his job. So I'm making an executive decision here because we know Sam well enough, and I know him in the sense that I know that he's for real and I know his backstory and I know his situation. And so knowing all of that, I want to share with you what his business is. And if you're so inclined, so you may perhaps go take a look at it and perhaps even, you know, do something that might be of benefit to him. So it is called Person-Centered. The company is called Person-Centered, and it's that's the website, personcentered.com. Sam Evans is his name. He's a licensed professional counselor. And he counsels people with DUI, alcohol, or drug risk problems. So he offers DUI, alcohol, or drug risk reduction programs. He offers clinical substance abuse evaluations. He has, as a licensed professional counselor, a variety of ways that he can help. Anger management counseling, family violence intervention, And other things. I'm looking at this long list of things, mental health evaluations. Now, he is obviously located in his area. He's in Athens, Georgia, and most people listening are not in Athens, Georgia, but he also does telehealth, I see here from his website. So if this is something that you would be interested in looking into for the purpose maybe of helping to support the good work that he does, then there you have it. Personcentered.com is his website. And you should be able to reach him probably by email that way as well. And this is not being told to you without his permission. So I want to make sure you understand that we're not like going public with his personal information. He not only consented to it, I think he felt kind of relieved to hear that I might be making this information available. So Personcentered.com. Please don't call Relevant Radio and ask them, what was the name of that thing? It's personcentered.com. And Sam is the proprietor. So we're going to go to the phones now. Let's go to, where are we going to go? Let's go to Joe, listening in the Bay Area of California. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning, Patrick. Just a quick question. I went to the Latin Mass over the weekend. It's only the second time I've went, but I just enjoyed it, and I'm reading along. I have no clue otherwise what's going on, but mm-hmm. I just had a general question: is why can't the old Mass be done in English? I mean, the form is beautiful the whole way it's done, but just done in English.
Well, in an absolute sense, I don't think that it couldn't be done. The opposite is done. In other words, the new rite of the Mass is done in Latin, but I've never heard of anybody asking for the traditional rite of the Mass to be translated and celebrated in English. I don't know the answer to that question. I think people who are attached to the traditional Mass, now I myself love the traditional Latin Mass, and although we don't attend it on any regular basis, if I have an opportunity, I very much enjoy doing so. But I think you would find an outcry from the people who love the traditional Latin Mass and go to it on a regular basis for the same reasons as you might find if you were to ask one of the rites in the Catholic Church, let's say the Chaldean rite or one of the other rites that celebrates the Divine Liturgy in their language. If you were to say to them, hey, you can celebrate your Divine Liturgy the same way you do now, except translated into English and use that language. I think people in those rites would be rightfully, no joke, I think they would be rightfully unhappy with that suggestion because that's the nature of their divine liturgy and the nature of their rite in some cases, the actual language that it's in. So I would foresee that kind of a negative reaction if somebody, let's say a pope, for example, were to propose something like that. But that's just my conjecture.
Mm-hmm. I think it's just, it's an, in the sense that I remember one time a discussion on this, that one of the reasons that the Mass was in Latin was just because that was more of a universal language. And it was the idea that something that most people could share. And I just think that it's beautiful the way it's done, everybody facing and really focusing. And I just think the couple times I've went, despite the fact that it's not in my native language, I feel like I'm not focusing on the priest. I'm not focusing on anything other than the prayers and trying to, understand the order of the Mass. And I just think just an idea and a thought.
Well, I'm not shooting it down. I'm just offering what I think the reaction would be. To your point, one thing in addition is that was one of the remarkably wonderful things of the traditional Latin Mass is that it was very unifying, because you could go anywhere in the world and attend that Mass, and everybody in every church anywhere in the world, regardless of the native language, the vernacular language, regardless of the culture, they would be saying the same prayers in the same language. It was a very big unity builder. And one of the unintended side effects, it seems to me, after the new rite of the Mass was promulgated, was it had the tendency to be very divisive, in the sense that it divided people by language. So you've got, what time is the Spanish Mass? What time is the Tagalog Mass? What time is this Mass? Now, in itself, the church wants to serve the communities, and I understand that. But one of the things that we lost as a result of it was we lost that unity that we had prior, that Catholicity in a small C sense, where it was universal, and this Mass was, in the Latin rite of the church, it was universal for all Catholics everywhere. So that's another unfortunate consequence, it seems to me, that we have become disunified. And I'll go one step further and say, what a shame it is that in some parishes you've got, in essence, two parishes, sometimes more than two, at the same parish, where the Mexican folk, the Spanish-speaking Mexican folk, typically, they show up for their Mass. They never see any of the other people in the parish, and those other people in the parish never see them. And then maybe you've got the Vietnamese group and the various other groups. We should all be together, if you ask me. We should be one people together worshiping God. And I've always looked askance at that. Anyway, Joe, thanks for letting me opine on your opinion. Thank you for that. 888-914-9149. How about Cecilia now in San Antonio, Texas? Good morning, Cecilia.
Hi, Patrick. I have a question with regard to eating out on Sundays. Sometimes, I eat out on Sundays with my family, and I always wonder whether I am contributing to other people not keeping Sunday holy.
Yes, it's a good question, and Pope John Paul II addresses that and other related issues in his document. I believe it's an encyclical. It's called Dies Domini, which means the Day of the Lord. And it's available if you go to the Vatican website. It's vatican.va. And just go to John Paul II's encyclicals, and you'll find it there. It's his treatise on how we are supposed to keep holy the Lord's Day. And the general principle is that if you are going out to eat, and this is part of your family get-together, enjoying family time, and it's restful and it's recreational, that would not be a problem. In fact, in some sense, it actually would be a benefit to the people who have to work on Sunday. Some people have to work on Sunday. They don't have a choice. And if you are facilitating their livelihood, that's a good thing. But if you're doing it, just because you want to do that, and it's not part of your setting aside that day for rest and thinking about God and the things of God and family time, then I would say try to avoid it. That's my sense of what Pope John Paul II says in Dies Domini, which is, the things that are unnecessary or servile work, as they're often referred to, duties like shopping and other things. If you're just doing it on Sunday because you didn't get around to it before, but you don't really have to do it, then they should be avoided. But if it's part of your genuine way of resting and relaxing and spending family time and thinking about the good blessings that God has given you, then it would be permissible. Do you see the distinction there?
Yes, so it just depends on my intention.
I'd say intention and circumstances. You know, what are the circumstances? Is it, you know, is it that, well, I just don't feel like cooking today, and so I'm going to go out to eat because I'd rather not be bothered with cooking. I would say that would be a, you know, a reason that doesn't really rise to the level of why would I be going out to eat or to go shopping. Let's take shopping as an analog. So let's say you're going to have a big family get together or even just a few family members over and you realize, oh my gosh, I forgot the ground beef or I forgot, you know, the wine or what have you. And you need to run up to the grocery store to get something that's necessary for your meal. That's not violating the commandment. But if, get to use this as a parallel here, if you could have gone shopping any other day of the week for your family groceries and you just put it off and here's Sunday and, well, I have to go do the groceries, I would avoid that on Sunday for that reason, because it's unnecessary work.
Yes, I think I understand. I think the way I would see it is if I'm enjoying my family, we usually go out to eat after going to Mass together.
Mm-hmm. We do that too sometimes.
That would be okay. But if I'm at home, sitting at home by myself, and I'm just like, oh, I'm too lazy to, you know, make myself a sandwich, let me just go grab something at the restaurant at the corner, then that would be something a little more problematic.
I think so. And maybe the best way I could put it is, we're dealing here with the spirit of the law, not the letter of the law. So the church doesn't say, you know, that you're not permitted to go to a restaurant on a Sunday. The church does not say you're not permitted to go to a grocery store on a Sunday. Rather, what the church says is that the spirit of this commandment to keep holy the Lord's Day means that you're giving it over, you're dedicating it to rest and to prayer and time with family, if you have family there to visit with. It's not like you have to. And that's the way the day should be spent. It should not be spent doing work or catching up on things you didn't do before. Now, it's different if you have to do this. So let's say that you were, you know, working all week and you worked yesterday or you worked Saturday and you have to mow the lawn on Sunday. It's the first day you've had a chance to do it because there's a huge rainstorm coming Sunday night and it's going to be raining for the next week or something like that. In a situation like that, it becomes necessary. It's like the story where Jesus in the Gospels, he talks about, or it was posed to him, a man who pulled his donkey, I think it was, out of a ditch because he had fallen into a ditch, the donkey did, on the Sabbath. And so this good believing Jew, he pulled the donkey out of the ditch lest it die. And the Pharisees were up in arms about this because that was work. And the point Jesus made was the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. Sometimes on the Sabbath, you have to do things like pulling your donkey out of the ditch or, in the case of Jesus and the apostles, picking grains of wheat and eating on the Sabbath. The Pharisees looked at that and said, that's work. You're sinning. You shouldn't do that. And Jesus said, you know, that I am the Lord of the Sabbath, in essence. You know, I determine how the Sabbath should be observed, and sometimes it's necessary to do things. And I think that's the key. That's the spirit. Is it necessary or unnecessary? Does it contribute to really observing the Lord's Day well, or does it detract from that? And if you have that in mind, I think then these kinds of decisions can become much easier.
Okay. Well, thank you for your insight on that.
You're welcome. And you know what we'll do, Cecilia? We'll get a link to that document from Pope John Paul II. We'll get that posted on the show Twitter feed. And you can access it by going to relevantradio.com/Patrick. Just look in the Twitter section. You'll find it there. Well, thank you. Break time, and we'll come back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show and your phone calls. The number is 888-914-9149. Got some NFL news that might irk you. And also, I'm going to tell you what the former IT minister in Afghanistan is doing now, right after this.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888 888- 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on Coast to Coast on Relevant Radio.
All right, we are back. I like that music, Cyrus. You anticipated my story that involves the NFL. So here goes. Courtesy of the Daily Caller, the NFL is paying close attention to unvaccinated players. Buffalo Bills receiver Isaiah McKenzie tweeted a letter Thursday morning from the NFL informing him that the league knew of his specific movements during specific moments when he wasn't wearing a mask on team grounds. Masks, as you may know, are required for all unvaccinated players. Not only did the NFL know about it, but the league knew the times and the locations as if they had spotted him on security cameras. So here's the letter that he received on August the 26th from the National Football League, addressed to, and it was handed to him in person and also sent to him by email, to Isaiah McKenzie, Buffalo Bills. Dear Isaiah, on August 25th, 2021, at approximately 2:15 p.m., while walking through the indoor field house and into the training room, you failed to wear a mask. Then at approximately 4:35 p.m. on August 25th, for several minutes, you again failed to wear a mask in the meeting area of the weight room while gathered near other players after the offensive meeting. And I should say offensive meeting, because I don't think the meeting was offensive, although he was offensive because he didn't wear a mask. Your refusal to wear a mask occurred after you were informed that it was required for unvaccinated players as set forth in your 2021 club discipline schedule and as reiterated by signage throughout the club facility, stating that unvaccinated players may be subject to fines and discipline for failing to wear a mask. Your refusal to wear a mask also occurred shortly after league staff gave a presentation on August 25th regarding the NFLPA COVID-19 protocols, including the mask wearing requirement and that unvaccinated players are subject to fines and discipline for refusal to wear a mask. In addition, blah, 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 blah. Still again, as noted, you refuse to wear a mask at the club facility. For players who are not fully vaccinated against COVID-19 like you, your conduct is expressly prohibited by the protocols. Again, your conduct potentially compromised not only your safety, but also the safety of others, as well as the league's ability to ensure that your club's training camp is conducted in a safe manner. The protocols, and then they append the protocols to it. They zapped him. And I'm guessing it's probably by using cameras, which they would have in place to see who's coming and going and doing what. McKenzie was spotted without a mask. And part of the repercussion is that the NFL fined him $14,650. Another player, Cole Beasley, also fined for not wearing a mask. A person tweeted, after the NFL fined them each $14,650 for refusal to wear a mask, the Buffalo Bills wide receivers Cole Beasley and Isaiah McKenzie are now subject to increased discipline for a repeat violation, including for conduct detrimental, with a maximum fine of 1 week's salary and a 4-game unpaid suspension. Fines for refusal to wear a mask were part of the NFLPA protocols. The difference this year is only unvaccinated players are required to wear masks inside the facility, among other restrictions, and thus subject to discipline for violations. Now, I do take note of the fact that it seems to be the case that people who are vaccinated are also getting sick with COVID and spreading it to other people. So it's interesting to see how the NFL is cracking down just on those players who are unvaccinated, even though, according to the general thought, the general public should be wearing masks whether or not they've been vaccinated. And I mean, that doesn't really take into account the questions that some scientists and physicians are raising about the efficacy of masks in the first place. Masks are another area of contention in the scientific community. I think overwhelmingly it's said that they are helpful, but they're not for COVID, I don't think, because the holes in the fabric of the masks, at least the ones that people typically wear, are far too large by comparison to the size of the coronavirus itself, which can easily pass through that. So for your good to know file. And then lastly, Syed Ahmad Shah Sadat, who was the former Minister of Communications and Information Technology in Afghanistan. So he was at the cabinet level, for whatever that's worth. He's now delivering pizzas by bicycle in Leipzig, Germany. This according to Newsweek. He says, I lead a simple life now. I'm not ashamed of my work, and I do not feel inferior. He had been the Minister of Communications for the Afghan government for the past 2 years, and then when the Taliban took over, he had to get out of Dodge, as you might imagine. On Facebook, he said, despite having 2 master's degrees and a bachelor's degree and 20 years of work experience, I did not know the German language and could not find a job in Germany in my profession. He says, man was created by God to work and worship. So in order to move life forward, and in order to move forward in life, rather, we must work. He was contacted by a manager of Life Rando, the delivery company he works for, and he was offered a job in the communications department. So he says in another tweet, he says, I am a qualified professional after learning the German language and will be back working in the telecommunications sector. So moral of the story there is he was pretty high on the totem pole and he was reduced to delivering pizzas to make ends meet. But he did what he had to do and he learned a new language and now he's back at his job. So bully for him. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Marge in Oak Park, Illinois. Hi, Marge.
Hi, Patrick. Patrick, I have an issue that I'm really struggling with. I have a 20-year-old granddaughter that I've raised since she's 8 years old.
Okay.
She did have a trauma-based early childhood, abandonment issues with both her mother and father. But she's in college now. She's 20. And she's been circled by, my family's been very Christ-centered, and we pray, you know, we're in church, pray, everything, Catholic. And she's in college now, at a small Christian college in Michigan. But I still have this issue where she lies, even over something very small. And I'm getting to the point of unforgiveness with her when she does this and getting angry and, you know, abandonment. I threatened last night. I was so upset. I threatened. It was over something very small, but I threatened abandonment, and I shouldn't have done that, I know, because that's her core, one of her core issues. But I don't know how to get through to her the seriousness of even a small lie.
Does she lie in general, or is it just about small things?
She's lied about something big a few times about, you know, there was a period of when she was 16, 17, where she was sneaking around with a boy that she knew I wouldn't approve of. She's not acted out sexually. She doesn't drink. She's never gone to parties. She mingles with mostly Christ-centered Christian friends that are very good and wholesome and that. So I'm not worried about, you know, a big sexual acting out or drinking or anything like that. There was an episode with her boyfriend, who's a very, very good person, at college, and it was an incident, and she ended up, you know, she told me lies about it, but I found out other things about how it actually happened.
Yesterday
was a small thing.
But that was that's what touched off the powder keg, right?
Yes. It was just something about a family friend who gave her some money as she was leaving for college. And I said to her in the car, did Uncle Eddie give you money? And she said no. But then I was talking to, and that's fine, you know, because I never take her money. It's her own money. But I was talking to him, and he said, when I gave Cam the money, I told her this or this. And so I confronted her. And
right.
Yeah.
Well, here's some thoughts on my part, since you're asking for some advice. Number one, she's 20 now, so she's at the point where, as an adult, she's going to have to start living with the real-world consequences of lying. And if she's lying to you, chances are she's lying to other people, too. So maybe when you're calm and things are not tense and you sit down with her and just say, and I just want to talk to you a little bit about this issue of lying. And I'm not going to give you a lecture. I'm not going to, you know, do any of those things. I just want to share with you a couple quick items. Number one, it hurts me personally that you lie to me when I love you and all I want to do is take care of you and help you and all the things that you would want someone to do for you. That's what I want to do for you. But you make it very difficult, or you even tie my hands because I can't trust you because you're lying. And, you know, if you're not going to stop lying, I can't stop you. But this is the second thing I want to tell you. And that is that you're about to launch into your own life on your own at some point. And if you want to stay here with me, I mean, this part, I'm winging it. But let's say that you said, if you want to stay here with me for the time being, that's fine. I love you and I want to see you happy. And I'll do everything I can to take care of you. Now, if you make it impossible for me, that's on you. That's not on me. That's on you. But just know that I love you and I want you to be happy. But the world does not love you. And the world couldn't care less about your happiness. So just take note that if you go out into that big wild world and you start do this with employers and other people, you're setting yourself up for a very miserable life. And I'd like to help you avoid that if at all possible, but only you can be the one who will make this change. I can't change you. I can't do it for you. But I'm telling you right now, you're going to have a very miserable life if you continue lying, because your employer doesn't love you. And your employer is not interested in your happiness and well-being. Your employer is interested in you doing your job. And if you lie about things, you're going to get fired. And then you're going to get fired again. And then you're going to have a hard time getting hired because you have a track record of being fired. And why are you being fired? Well, because you have a problem with not telling the truth. If you want to get married, the one person in the whole world that you should love above all others and be honest with above all others is going to be your husband. And if you walk into that marriage with a habit of lying, you're going to lose your marriage at some point. Now, I don't know how much more you would need to say than that, but at least you've let her know that, number one, this is her problem to fix. It's no one else's fault but her own. And you can tell her that these consequences are waiting for you if you keep this up. And then, you know, I would just say, if it's comfortable enough that she can live with you off and on when she comes back from college, that's great. If she continues doing this and you have to part ways, I could understand if it gets to that point. But at least you've done your duty and you didn't scream and shout and you didn't raise your blood pressure. You just told her like it is. And I have a feeling that that kind of calm, clinical, here's what's going to happen to you if you keep doing this, I think that will stick in her mind. And then maybe it will take some real disasters. Maybe it will take some self-inflicted wounds like that to wake her up. But the truth of what you tell her will become apparent to her in due time, I think.
Thank you very much. I'll do that.
Okay. I'm just offering advice, you know, from a distance, but
that's good advice though. Yeah.
I think it will help.
I have to, I think I've shamed her at this point. I'm really so upset, but I'll make an amend for that and then approach it.
Yeah. And that would be a good thing. You know, I love you. I'm sorry. If what I said yesterday hurt you, I really apologize. I don't want to hurt you. I love you. I want you to be happy. I mean, those are all really good positive messages to reinforce. And then maybe follow it up by saying, you know, I love you so much that I'm going to tell you the truth. And, you know, if you went into the doctor because you had some mysterious pain and the doctor ran tests and x-rays and found the problem, you would want him to tell you, wouldn't you? Well, I'm going to tell you something going on with you that you need to hear. And then, I don't know, leave it between her and God and keep praying for her. Thanks, Marge. I appreciate it. You know, this is when you're raising children, this is one of those potential pitfalls, especially if a child has a propensity toward lying. You know, without getting into any specifics, one of my sons went through a phase of this when he was a teenager. And I told him, I said, son of mine, you know, if you do these things here in this house, mom and I will get unhappy about that and we'll tell you not to do it. But eventually, when you move out on your own, sooner or later, someone is going to punch you in the face for doing the things that mom and I are telling you not to do here. If you continue to do this into your life as an adult, sooner or later, somebody will literally punch you in the face. And if it doesn't literally happen, it will figuratively happen where life will punch you in the face. Your employer will punch you in the face by firing you. And I was really very blunt with him. And I said, and if you think that you're going to get married and have a wonderful life with the woman that you love, if you keep this kind of stuff up, that will punch you in the face. And you'll look back later and say, you know, if only I had done things differently, I would still be married. And I said, I don't want any of those things for you because I love you and I want you to be happy. But I'm telling you, if you keep this up, that's what's going to happen. And you know what? He changed his ways. And I wonder if maybe between my message to him and when he began to sort of pull away from that stuff, if maybe he did get punched in the face, figuratively speaking, a few times. And maybe he thought to himself, you know what? My dad's right, and I don't want to live this way. So he made some changes, and he's much the better for it. Let's take a break, and we'll come right back to your phone calls. The number is 888-914-9149. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
You can call right now, 888-914-9149. We do have lines open, and you can grab one. Let's go to Greg in Baltimore, Maryland. Good morning, Greg. Welcome.
Good morning. I have a question and a comment. The question is regarding the side altars. Traditionally, at least in America, I'm familiar with having the Blessed Virgin Mary's altar on the gospel side and the old gospel side and the St. Joseph's on the old epistle side. When I was visiting in Germany, there was a church where that was reversed, and I asked a parishioner why, and they had no remote clue. So I was just curious if you knew when it started to become standard to have these altars and what governs their placement.
Well, okay, so I think there's two questions here. One is, when was it customary to have the side altars? And then what is the custom about having Mary on one side and Joseph on the other? Do I have the questions right?
Yeah, I would say so.
Okay. Well, we see evidence of side altars, certainly in medieval churches in Europe, for example. I don't think in the first centuries of the church in the ancient basilicas, I don't believe that there were side altars. I think as the monastic communities began to grow and flourish and proliferate, the practice of having the monks, the priests, and other priests celebrate Mass as part of their daily routine, it took the form of needing some of these side altars because, let's say that you had a community with 20, 30 priests, well, you couldn't have 20 or 30 Masses each day, and they did not concelebrate in those days. So to have side altars was the best way for these priests to celebrate the Holy Sacrifice of the Mass. And otherwise, in a single church, for example, you would not be able to accommodate all those Masses in a single day. So I think by necessity, that's where this came from. There was also the understanding, too, and I certainly endorse this understanding, that celebrating Mass is the priest's highest duty. No matter what else he may do, celebrating the Holy Sacrifice of the Mass is his highest duty, because he's ordained as a priest to offer sacrifice. So that took pride of place. Therefore, side altars became necessary for that reason. Now, what about the custom of having, typically at least, an image of Our Lady on the left side altar and an image of St. Joseph on the right side altar? As I understand it, not being an expert on these matters, but as I understand it, I think it's far more customary to have at least an image of Mary in the sanctuary. It's not as common to have an image of St. Joseph. It's good. In fact, my parish has on the left side altar, as you face toward the sanctuary, the left side altar is the Marian altar. So there's the statue of Our Lady there. And then on the right side would be the statue of St. Joseph with baby Jesus. But many churches may only have Mary there, and they may not have a representation of St. Joseph. But in terms of, you know, what is the custom between Europe and the United States, I don't know. I think it's, my impression is that the custom has been to have Our Lady on the left side And the idea is that it comports with what we see in Scripture about Mary and St. John and the other holy women who are with Mary standing at the foot of the cross. But it doesn't say that she was on the left side or the right side. It doesn't say that. I think it's just in Christian art customary to show her standing to the left. So there you got it. You just exhausted my reservoir of knowledge about that topic.
Okay. Thank you very kindly.
You're welcome. Thank you. Now, if you're interested in a book that does get into some of these details, there's a two-volume work by Joseph Jungmann, J-U-N-G-M-A-N-N, on the history of the Roman Rite. And it is very interesting. And in addition to the history and the development of the rite itself and the prayers and gestures, it does get into some of the things about how the churches were, maybe in those ancient times compared to how they were later. Also, there's a work by Frederick Vandermeer. It's on Augustine, St. Augustine. It's called Augustine the Bishop, and it's about St. Augustine. And he has a rather lengthy section in that book about what the basilicas were like that the, for example, in the case of St. Augustine, that he preached in. You know, what were these churches like? How were they built? And one of the little details that I've gleaned from these studies is things such as there were no pews. The people, they stood for the whole Mass. And sometimes the sermons were quite long. So if you needed to sit, you'd sit on the floor. But it wasn't until later times that these churches would begin to install pews. That was a much later development, it seems. And but if you were to walk into a Mass in, let's say, the 4th or 5th century, you would know what was going on. If you're a Catholic, you would recognize the Mass as it's celebrated now. You would recognize how it was celebrated then. And even though some of the details would be somewhat different, and of course it would have been in Latin in the case of St. Augustine's day, nonetheless, you would have been able to follow it, and you would have known where things were in the Mass, which is an amazing thing, isn't it? How the Mass has been in such a stable form for so many centuries. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Carrie in San Diego. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Patrick. I have a question regarding a situation that I'm in, or both my husband and I are in.
Okay.
I've homeschooled for several years, my children, all eight of them. And as soon as they hit high school, I have three boys that have now going to a different school. And I am now focusing on my daughter, who is moving to ninth grade high school. And my husband and I are in a situation where there are not very many Catholic schools here in San Diego. Mm-hmm. Practicality and logistically, the school that we only agree with to send her to has no more room available. We're still continuing to send an application, of course, but that's on a hold. And we informed our daughter there. And the only school that we can send her to is a local high school. And it lends itself to practicality and logistically. My heart is really heavy to send her there. We enrolled. She's in there now. What should I do about a situation like this? Charter schooling is not really an option. And okay. I have two younger children that I'm homeschooling currently. And I don't want this to be a constant battle because I would if my daughter stayed at home, because it has been. And so what should I do with this situation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a tough one. So you want to avoid, I'm repeating this to you to make sure I have it right.
Okay.
You want to avoid putting her in a public school, but
correct.
You would prefer to put her in a Catholic school, but you have some reservations about the quality of some of the Catholic schools in your area. Is that right?
There is only one Catholic school we're willing to send her to,
and
it's 35, 40 minutes away. And
is there a
it
possibility?
Would harbor on.
Go ahead, sorry.
It's logistically and practicality. My husband and I both agree that it is a school that has a distance that would allow her, that would take away time from the little ones. I would basically be homeschooling in my car,
right.
And that would not be good.
Right. No, I get it. Is the possibility of homes? I'm sorry. The possibility of carpooling, is that present? I mean, are there other?
I have put it out there, and the school really, really, the school has they don't have very many connections. My husband and I thought about Ubering her there. I find that completely dangerous.
I wouldn't do that.
I put it out there for, I'm not comfortable. My heart is completely uneasy of sending her to school in this public school. I'm already seeing some influences that this is like the worst time ever to send anybody to public schools, and we do not trust it. We just feel like we ran out of options. And
well, then here's what I would suggest, Carrie. Just grin and bear it and homeschool her and just say, honey, it's not your first choice. It's not my first choice, but this is the only choice that we have right now. So we're both going to make the best of it. And if you're going to be homeschooled, I expect you to be cheerful about it. And then if things change such that we can get you into that other Catholic school in a way that's safe for you, then we'll do that. But in the meantime, you've got a lot of learning to do. So I expect you to be mature about this and to not give me a hard time. And we're going to be homeschooling. It seems like that's what you're down to.
Okay.
You know? I mean, what other choice do you have? She's got to go to school. So if the public school is out, and I completely understand why you would feel that way, so I back you on that. If the Catholic school option is not feasible, then the only other option you have is to homeschool her. So that's what you do. And don't put up with her nonsense if she starts up about, well, I don't want to be homeschooled. I don't want you to be homeschooled either, but that's the only choice we have right now. You see, let her know that you're not doing it to make her life miserable, because you'd rather wave goodbye to her as she gets on the bus to go to the local Catholic school, but that can't happen at the moment. So you do the best you can with what you've got. And she's expected to do the same thing.
Yes, I just don't want to disrupt the current peace right now, because I have to focus on the two little ones and there's the constant bucking. But I definitely want to put my foot down, but it is going to be a complete struggle pulling her out of this public school. And is it fair to keep her home? And then in the meantime, if in the event that opens up, she's midway through, and send her to that Catholic school if anything opens up for us. Is that fair to her, these transitions, simply because we're mandating for her to stay home?
I'm not sure if fairness is really the operative principle here. Rather, it's what is the best thing for her. So if her safety and virtue and innocence will be preserved by keeping her out of the public school, whether she likes it or not, you're doing it for her benefit. You know, and when you're in ninth grade, you don't know the world and you don't understand. You don't understand what the bigger picture is, so she'll look back later, I think, and thank you.
Okay.
You know, being fair, maybe what you mean, I mean, just is one thing. Fair is a kind of a slippery term right now, because it's not really a fairness issue. Is it fair for the doctor to give you some terrible tasting medicine? Well, it's not really a fairness issue. It's not fair or unfair. It's necessary. Is it fair that you have to go into the hospital for a painful procedure? Well, it's not really fair or unfair. It's necessary to save your life. So I would approach it from that standpoint that, honey, it's, you know, sometimes we in life, you have to deal with situations that you don't like. That's part of growing up. So you and I both would prefer it a different way. But for the time being, we'll do it this way, and I expect you to be cheerful. That's all I'm asking of you. Cooperate and be cheerful, and we'll make the best of it. And who knows? This may be a wonderful opportunity for her to grow up a little bit and to become more patient and more realistic about life. That'd be a good thing.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome. One last question. You haven't given her a smartphone, I hope, have you?
We have not. That's been also a constant battle. We gave her one of those track phones that my husband, till this day, has given the older boys this. Everybody complains. Everybody hates it. She wants to, the only thing that it can do is text and call. And my husband text, call, and receive phone calls, of course.
That's good.
And good at this point. She is outraged, and we continue to mandate it, and so she will not perform well if she does go to any school outside of the home. We decided to take a break this year, and she feels that she deserves that break and wants to experience this because
because all the other kids are.
Of course, has sports.
Because all the other kids are doing it. Yeah, stand your ground on this issue. And hey, by the way, everybody's tweeting and everybody's calling and say, hey, well, what about this Catholic homeschool program and that? Trust me, I'm very familiar with all of those. Very familiar. But the lady that I'm talking to wasn't asking me which curriculum to use. She was just referring to homeschool versus something else. Well, I wish you well, Carrie. And I'm hopeful that this new chapter in your daughter's, you know, school career will be one of great development for her. Well, she'll learn a few good lessons, and I hope it's a happy situation for both of you. I really do. Thanks for calling in. We're just about out of time, so we'll take a break and come back with more in the third hour of your calls and plenty of other things I want to talk to you about as well. 888-914-9149. Interesting question I want to ask you. Do multiple ear piercings indicate a midlife crisis? What do you think about that? Do they? Don't they? Is that a sign of something going on? We'll talk about that and much more on the other side of this quick timeout, so please stay right there.
Ooh, I don't want that on my karmic record.
No, I really don't.